Okay.
Do you want to read that opening sentence? Because that'll just be the opening for this thing.
When the days of rejoicing were over, at last the companions thought of returning to their own homes. Chapter 6, Book 6, Many Partings.
Let's just jump in with your Cliff Notes first, because I think it'll actually help. And then, not that it doesn't always help. Anyways, it'll help with our feelings, little feelings.
Nice catch, Patrick. Thanks.
What do you got?
Okay, so in this chapter, the Fellowship begins to unwind. The elves, the Rohirrim, and the Fellowship all make their way north and part ways as they go. First, Rohan, for the funeral of Théoden and the wedding of Faramir and Éowyn. Then, Isengard, where they meet Treebeard and send off Merry and Pippin. Then, Isengard, where they meet with Treebeard and send off Legolas and Gimli. After passing a haggard old Saruman on the road, Celeborn and Galadriel split for Lothlórien, and Aragorn turns back for Gondor. The rest travel to Rivendell, where the hobbits are reunited with Bilbo after many months.
All right. So, feelings. Before feelings, did you catch that this many partings is the reversal of the many meetings chapter from Rivendell?
I did not realize that until you said it just now, but it makes a ton of sense. I processed it plot-wise, but not the
chapter
titling as well.
Well, like, so he's playing with this too, because, like, the first chapter of The Hobbit is the unexpected party, and then the first chapter of Lord of the Rings is the long expected party. So, like, he does
very
that
clever,
kinda, yeah, goofy. All right, anyways, feelings about this chapter?
It's a really satisfying chapter, like, kind of sad because everyone's saying goodbye, but also feels like really, really nice closure in a way. Like, it's the first one, it feels like the first ending chapter. In a very nice way, not so much like a celebration or a triumphant victory or something, but just like the loose knots are being tied up and it's a little bit sad, but
it's very sad at times.
Yeah. But I kind of like, it's like
sad happy, in a good way though.
Happy
yeah,
sad.
Yeah.
Everyone's going home. It's like kind of exciting.
Well, we're going to throw in one part that's kind of sad, sad.
Yes. Yes.
But the big caveat, do you want to do it or should I say it?
You go for it.
It's way too long. This is, all the content was great. But this is way too long of a chapter. Like this you could, I'll tell you exactly where 2 points you could have broke it off and just put the stuff with the next chapter. You know, I mean, it's just like, because I'm looking at the next chapter and I don't even remember what happens, but it's only 8 pages and this one was like twice the length.
You've got to think that like Tolkien had a real conundrum trying to wrap up the story, right? Like, people make fun of Lord of the Rings for having 7 endings. He's got so many loose ends to tie up. And everything that happens in this chapter, I'm like, I would not get rid of any of this. Like, this is pretty vital closure of the plot.
Yeah, and this is also that he's doing something else, I think, too, that we'll hit on as we go through it, though. But yeah. All right, should we jump in, though? Oh, and then since it's so long, we gotta be snappy. We cannot be dwelling on anything. We gotta act like this is a big chapter and just go at it full force. You know, storm it like waves.
Sounds good.
All right. Do you want? I guess we're gonna take it from the top because it's kind of an important scene. So yeah, why don't you start?
When the days of rejoicing were over, at last the companions thought of returning to their own homes. And Frodo went to the king as he was sitting with the Queen Arwen by the fountain, and she sang a song of Valinor while the tree grew and blossomed. They welcomed Frodo and rose to meet him, and Aragorn said,
"I know what you have come to say, Frodo. You wish to return to your own home. "Well, dearest friend, the tree grows best in the land of its sires, but for you and all the lands of the West, there will ever be a welcome. And though your people have had little fame in the legends of the great, they will now have more renown than any wide realms that are no more."
"It is true that I wish to go back to the Shire," said Frodo, "but first I must go to Rivendell. For if there could be anything wanting in a time so blessed, I missed Bilbo, and I was grieved when among all the household of Elrond I saw that he was not come."
"Did you wonder at that, Ringbearer?" said Arwen. "For you know the power of that thing which is now destroyed, and all that was done by that power is now passing away. But your kinsman possessed this thing longer than you. He is ancient in your years, according to his kind, and he awaits you, for he will not again make any long journey save one." All right. Quick thoughts on that. I just thought Aragorn's lines were awesome. Cool.
Yes, absolutely.
Even though he's the king of kings, basically, you know, he's... one of the books pointed out, he always says the right thing.
Yes.
Always treats everybody lower than him with incredible respect. It's pretty awesome.
Kind, respectful. He's got foresight. He knows what Frodo's thinking before Frodo says it. But also,
yeah,
I mean, maybe everyone saw this coming, but they're kind of alluding here that Bilbo might be at the end of his life, or very
well
is past the end of his life, and you know, is really not in the same place he was at the start of the book.
Yeah, so that's the first inkling that everything's coming to an end, is that they're saying, hey, the ring's destroyed now, everything that was supposed to fade away that was tied to the ring, yeah, that's about to come true. So the first mention here is Bilbo, okay? And then I guess maybe, well, anyways, we do get to see him at the end of the chapter. So maybe that could be justification why he's in this chapter and not just in the next. Mm-hmm. But anyways, Aragorn says that they're all going to leave together to go to Rohan because Éomer's coming back to take Théoden's body, which they still haven't had the funeral for, right? Mm-hmm. So then Aragorn's going to, he's trying to give Frodo a gift of his choosing, but Arwen actually butts in, and then... What did Queen Arwen say?
"But the Queen Arwen said, 'A gift I will give you, for I am the daughter of Elrond. I shall not go with him now when he departs to the Havens, for mine is the choice of Lúthien, and as she so have, I have chosen, but both the sweet and the bitter. But in my stead you shall go, Ringbearer, when the time comes, and if you then desire it. If your hurts grieve you still, and the memory of your burden is heavy, then you may pass into the west until all your wounds and weariness are healed. But wear this now in memory of Elfstone and Evenstar, with whom your life has been woven.'
And she took a white gem like a star that lay upon her breast, hanging upon a silver chain. And she set the chain about Frodo's neck. 'When the memory of the fear and the darkness troubles you,' she said, 'this will bring you aid.'" All right. Thoughts on that? This is kind of a big conversation. That was kind of a must read.
Yeah. One small note and then a big note. The small one, there's this, it's almost like a pattern we've seen at this point of the tokens being bestowed, the kind of light in the darkness, just like Galadriel giving Frodo the file.
The file, yeah.
Here a similar thing, but the big bit, at least to me, is, and it's almost buried, if you're skimming through this really quickly, that Arwen is saying, Frodo, you can go to the Grey Havens, meaning, and then go to Valinor, basically. The place that only elves can go. Literally, men are allowed there.
Well, no mortals, right?
No mortals. Yeah, huge parts of the Silmarillion revolve around mortals even attempting to go there.
Right.
That's a huge deal that Frodo is being given permission to go there. But also kind of a weird, it's a twist for him.
Yeah. Okay, well, so let's first address Arwen, though. So why is she able to give up this spot?
She's staying with Aragorn, right?
Right.
The choice of Lúthien is the choice of being half elven and choosing to be man half, right? Right?
Yeah, she's fully elven, but she's choosing to be mortal, just like Lúthien chose to be mortal to stay with
Elrond
for
one half elven.
Right, but he chose to be fully elven, so Arwen becomes his name's Elrond half elven, but he's fully elven.
Okay.
But of descent he was actually half elven. It's confusing, but he kind of, well, anyways, we don't have to get into that. All right, so anyways, then back to Frodo. So Arwen, we're gonna deal with that in a little bit, her choice a little bit more in this chapter. But Frodo, like you're saying, he gets to take the spot. So the bigger question is, why would Frodo need the spot?
Yeah.
We don't get an answer. We don't even get a response from Frodo to this to this.
Right.
Like, you shall if you desire it, but...
Notably, it sounds like she's saying, if your hurts grieve you still, and the memory of your burden is heavy. In other words, like, if you can't deal with the fact that you just, like, if you can't fully process and get over what you just did and the trauma of carrying the ring for that long, going into the Undying Lands will be the ultimate kind of respite for you.
Right, right. Okay. All right. We got to keep trucking, though. Okay, so there's a goofy but super endearing conversation between Éomer and Gimli about who's more beautiful, Galadriel or Arwen, which is weird because they're not married to either, but and they never will be. But anyways, you gotta read that one for yourself, because we actually skipped when Éomer and Gimli originally met. Éomer, not really knowing anything good about Lothlorien, somewhat badmouth Galadriel, and then he takes it back in this conversation. But anyways, it was really funny. Definitely worth the read. Hopefully everybody's reading along, of course, right? So anyways, everyone you can think of sets off together with Théoden's body. They march north. This is the greatest procession any king of Rohan has ever had. Théoden, my guy, most improved award. I love it.
Pretty awesome.
All right, and while we're on the topic, just real quick, if you can think off the top of your head, do you have a most improved character award to give out for this podcast?
Ooh.
You can save it for our last episode, too, if you don't have it
now. I could make an argument for Sam, potentially.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What? You're saying Sam wasn't already just... highest of echelons?
No, he started out fine, but I think he really he was I mean, I guess you could say in some ways he was MVP, but
chief hero, dude, chief hero.
Yeah.
Token himself said that.
I think Sam, it takes a little while for him to emerge as the critical player that he is, so I would say that's a good one. Théoden's a great one. I'll think on it further.
See, Sam's pretty great too, because like you could name your kid Sam and it would sound normal.
You can't name your kid Théoden.
Everybody else has to be a middle name, and I say this with the straightest of faces. Like, just watch out. Awesome. Anyways, they travel past. Okay, so they travel past Amandine in the forest, and there's a little nod to the Druidane, who are the small people that helped Rohan through. And it was such an awesome chapter. This is
the stone mason guy. What was his name?
Gonberry Gon,
yes.
Yeah, and they take the stone way through so that Rohan can avoid the trap, and then they get to... It's such a fun chapter because it's not in the movie. You don't really know what's going on. It's the bizarrest friendship, arguably, that you see in the whole books. But then, it's just so memorable and unique and just perfect. And it leads up. That chapter ends with the Rohan charge, which is like, in everybody's top three favorite moments of the series. If you have a soul. Anyways, the heralds cry out to this forest, on the edge of the forest. They say, "Behold, the king Eleazar is come. The forest of Druidan he gives to Gonberry Gon and to his folk to be their own forever. And hereafter let no man enter into it without their leave." Then the drums rolled loudly and were silent. And that is all you need on that one. Well done.
Yeah, but it feels kind of like representative of the chapter. Like there's these little bits, loose end being tied up. Everyone's having their. It's like they're kind of doing justice to these different characters we've met along the way.
So, and we get to revisit everything that was like in the darkest hour. Now it's kind of
right.
It's the
happy. And their grievances are being allayed. Like Gonberry Gon had like this historic frustration, and now it's allayed. So. Yeah,
King's setting everything right. Yeah, right. So. All right, So 15 days later, they get to Edoras. Golden Hall sounds cool. They bury Theoden in one of the mounds. Nine on one side. Now there's eight on the other because he's the eighth, because it was nine lines of kings, and then it kind of goes to a nephew, so it's a second line. So anyways, now it's eight. I think when Éomer dies, because he's only a nephew, they're probably going to start a third line, I would guess. But I don't know. Anyways, well, actually, we won't see. But let's pass the end of this. But anyways... Originally, I was going to say we should read this next part just because it's super epic. Then I realized it's peak Tolkien. And then I realized he might subtly be doing something very profound here. Mm. So I'm going to start this.
Okay.
Then the riders of the king's house upon white horses rode round about the barrow and sang together a song of Théoden Thangle's son that Gleonwine, his minstrel, made, and he made no other song after. The slow voices of the riders stirred the hearts even of those who did not know the speech of that people, but the words of the song brought a light to the eyes of the folk of the Mark as they heard again afar the thunder of the hooves of the north, and the voice of Errol crying above the battle upon the field of Celebrant, and the tale of the kings rolled on, and the horn of Helm was loud in the mountains until the darkness came, and King Théoden arose and rode through the shadow to the fire and died in splendor, even as the sun, returning beyond hope, gleamed upon Mindoluin in the morning.
Out of doubt, out of dark, to the day's rising, he rode singing in the sun, sword unsheathing. Hope he rekindled, and in hope ended, over death, over dread, over doom lifted, out of loss, out of life, unto long glory.
All right, feelings on that one?
Epic.
Oh yeah,
a fine send off for Théoden.
Yeah. All right, so I got lots of thoughts here, and I think most of these are just my own thoughts too, but anyways, so there were lines from the Moria chapters, if you can remember all the way back to then, where Gimli's eyes were kind of smoldering is what they said. And it's hard to fully capture why, but it was kind of some sort of insane pride of like the legacy of his people, but in pride in a good sense, right?
Right, right.
And I don't even know what to compare it to today. Maybe like American soldiers about the flag or something, you know, might be the closest, but I don't even know if that would fully capture it, you know? But anyways, I think the same thing's going on here in Rohan as for this passage here, right? Okay, so you gotta remember, these people, no books, no literature. They pass on their tradition by oral tradition. So, like, this Gleonwine minstrel, this is his magnum opus, right? Mm-hmm. Greatest work. And, you know, he's doing this for his people, remembering the greatest of his people. And, you know, this is basically his contribution to, well, any sort of creation ever, you know, like capital C creation, right? Mm-hmm. And it even says he's never going to compose anything after this again. So, like, this is the best thing he's ever done. It's kind of like how Fëanor, like, he made the Silmarils, but then after that, like, they get captured and they're like, well, can you just make some new ones? He's like, nah, there's only certain works you can only do once in your life, you know? Right. And it's so that's the case with this guy with this minor song. All right, so all of that's super cool, right?
Agree absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so then he's bringing up Errol, who's the founder of the Rohan, or the people that brought him to Rohan, right? And then Helm Hammerhand, that guy was awesome. We talked about him at the Helm's Deep chapter. That's who it's named after. And then they put Théoden right up there with those guys. And it's like, oh, awesome, right? Okay. And then this paragraph, it's also oozing with that northern ferocity, right? Like Ragnarok courage, like we're going to fight the good fight even though we're going to die. But then I was thinking, it's like, well, look at these lines. It says Théoden died in splendor even as the sun returning beyond hope. And then in the song, it says, hope he rekindled, and in hope ended, over death, over dread, over doom lifted out of loss, out of life, until long glory. So, my thought is, this somewhat goes, you're going to have to help me piece this together too. This somewhat goes against that northern courage where it's oblivion at the end. Now they're introducing, at the end of the Rohan threads, or, you know, storylines, like, oh, maybe they do have hope, you know, like Théoden helped reignite hope in this bigger, larger cause that had like the catastrophe moment at the end where they actually made it through, even though they had all the northern courage. It's like, all right, well, there was something after. So I don't know. I'm like wondering if J.R.R. Tolkien's trying to attempt to like harmoniously provide like the source of hope for northern men or
Interesting. Interesting.
You know what I'm trying to say?
I think so. Yeah, I guess I don't know. I think you're right that it doesn't have to be inconsistent with like the sort of Christian hope that we've talked a lot about in with like Aragorn and Frodo, with the sort of Nordic epic narrative with Théoden and the Rohirrim.
Or like it's like so the one big thing, like if you remember all the way back to the Beowulf special, and we've talked about this too in the other parts of Lord of the Rings, like they were noble pagans, as in like they weren't Christians clearly, but you know, it was the author, it was a Christian author. And so then he made them definitely not pagans, as in like weird cult practices, right?
Right. Or any, right.
Like human sacrifice stuff, especially
made them compatible with Christianity, but not explicitly worshiping or something.
Yeah. People that would be open to Christianity, you know, like when they heard about it, right? When a first missionary would get there or something, you know, but I don't know. It seems like Tolkien's almost trying to set up like, yeah, we can hope in something, even though we, I don't know, like we had the courage because we were going to fight, even though, yeah, we just go into oblivion. But it's like, well, actually, maybe that's just not true. Like, maybe this is like the first inkling. It's like, maybe we don't actually go into oblivion, and there is like a sunrise beyond the last big dark battle, I guess, or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting. And maybe it sets a different tone for the future of Rohan or something like that, you know? It's not all about martyrdom or something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, Rohan's... I mean, it's pretty cool as it is, you know? I don't have too much problem with, but yeah, I mean, it's like they could be setting themselves up to, I don't know, welcome some sort of, more hopeful theology that, like, Christianity provides, you know? Mm-hmm. I guess would be my thought, I guess. I don't know. All right, anyways, let's keep going. Rohan heraldry stuff. Éomer, he's basically kind of honored by his people for the first time as king in Rohan, I think. Then again, he's been there for a couple months resetting the place, so maybe not. I don't know. It's in front of everybody. First time in front of everybody, right? And then Éomer confirms that Éowyn and Faramir have decided to get married, and he's happy for them. But I don't think this is their actual wedding. I think this is like their betrothal thing, right?
Okay. Yeah.
That's also another thing. I forgot to mention this last chapter, but it was a big chapter. You don't see weddings in this because it's like that's the noble pagan stuff, right? Like it's like, how would you officiate a wedding? Like, he doesn't have religion in this, right?
So, right. That's interesting.
But all these people would be religious of some sort, you would assume, unless they're purposely like leaves it out, right? You know. So I think it's only the betrothal. I don't think they actually get married on the spot like that, just because Éomer declares it for him.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't process that, but that makes a lot of sense. And they don't explicitly say anything about the wedding.
Right.
They also, Éomer uses some specific, like, old English term for the...
Oh, yeah. What does he use again?
Where is it? Troth plighted before you all.
That's it.
Like, I'm assuming that's some combination of, like, betrothed. Like, troth being kind of unified, and then plighted being like future, or like that's your destiny. So it's like unified and destiny or something. But yeah, never heard that one before.
All right. Well, so Aragorn's got kind of like a funny line there, because Faramir and Éowyn are going to get married, and then obviously Faramir's of Gondor, right? And so then what's Aragorn? Well, actually, I'll take Aragorn's line here. He says, "No niggard are you, Éomer," said Aragorn, "to give thus to Gondor the fairest thing in your realm."
Then Éowyn looked in the eyes of Aragorn, and she said, "Wish me joy, my liege lord and healer."
And he answered, "I have wished thee joy ever since I first saw thee. It heals my heart to see thee now in bliss." Oh, so like you were saying, definitely wrapping up storylines here. So.
Yeah, yeah. No, Éowyn's... no, we're not leaving any tension on the table.
Right, right. So Eowyn's storyline is about wrapped up here, or is wrapped up here. Because why? You explain it.
Because we knew that she had the hots for Aragorn at some point, was potentially disappointed that his heart was set on another, but she decided she loved Faramir, and here she's now committing to Faramir fully, and
she actually loved Faramir. She only loved kind of like the image of Aragorn almost.
Aragorn is wishing her well, and she's kind of graciously accepting of that. So
yeah, and it's also low-key cool of Aragorn how he kind of like he interjects here, obviously, but he doesn't steal the show. This isn't his kingdom, you know, and what he says is just, again, it's probably about perfect. what you could have said in this situation. So.
Right, a fine compliment to Eowyn, and then which she clearly takes well.
Right, right. Okay, then do you want to take this next paragraph though about Arwen? This is going to be the only heavy part of the chapter that we do, I would say. Everything else it's still the rosy mood, but yeah. All right, why don't you take it here?
When the feast was over, those who were to go took leave of King Ymir. Aragorn and his knights and the people of Lorien and of Rivendell made ready to ride, but Faramir and Imrahil remained at Edoras, and Arwen even Sar remained also, and she said farewell to her brethren. None saw her last meeting with Elrond, her father, for they went up into the hills and they spoke long together, and bitter was their parting that should endure beyond the ends of the world.
Okay, so just first question, why is ends of the world pluralized? What is it? I get one.
I think to me, end of the world singular implies something in time. Like an event that is the end of the world, but ends implies more like geography. I kind of read it as like they're like the whole thing with the Undying Lands that the elves go to is like a spatial ending for them. Like they're going to a different place to be the end of their life in a way. The Undying Lands.
Yeah, but it's all right, a little confusing
because Arwen's not gonna go there, right?
Right, correct. So that's what I want to read now. So we did a whole Aragorn and Arwen special, right?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't finish it off because we wanted to build suspense. The ending with it fits completely with this chapter, besides that it's a little bit darker than the rest of the chapter. But I think it's just worth going over it now, even if it takes us an extra 10-15 minutes, whatever it's going to end up being. But anyways, it's like I said, it slightly ruins the mood a little bit, but it perfectly fits, so I think we got to do it. Plus, we need closure on this. But anyways, what we're actually about to read is like the future deaths that take place beyond the book of Aragorn and Arwen. So anyways, just brace yourself.
All right. Thus the years drew on to the War of the Ring, of which more is told elsewhere. How the means unforeseen was revealed whereby Sauron might be overthrown, and how hope beyond hope was fulfilled. And it came to pass that in the hour of defeat, Aragorn came up from the sea and unfurled the standard of Arwen in the Battle of the Fields of Pelennor. And in that day he was first hailed as king. And at last, when all was done, he entered into the inheritance of his fathers and received the crown of Gondor, the scepter of Arnor. And at midsummer, in the year of the fall of Sauron, he took the hand of Arwen and Dormiel, and they were wedded in the City of the Kings. The third age ended thus, in victory and hope, and yet grievous among the sorrows of that age was the parting of Elrond and Arwen, for they were sundered by the sea and by a doom beyond the end of the world. When the great ring was unmade and the three were shorn of their power, then Elrond grew weary at last and forsook Middle-earth, never to return. But Arwen became as a mortal woman, and yet it was not her lot to die until all that she had gained was lost.
It's just, sorry, I don't know if I actually said it at the beginning, but we're reading from Appendix A here. This is the Arwen and Aragorn tale that you can find in the back there, just at the back of the book. Anyways, so yeah, so this is kind of heavy. So this is Aragorn's death scene, and this takes place basically 120 years after Lord of the Rings. So he's going to be the king for 120 years more after the chapter that we're reading right now, okay? Anyways, his lifespan's coming to an end, and Aragorn knows it. Arwen's super crushed. She sounds, if you read the conversation, because we'll read part of it, but we're not going to read all of it. She sounds a lot like the Andreth and Finrod special, where they were all very emotional about death and, I don't know, like parting forever, you know, and everything. And like part of that that comes up is because she's going to die herself and not see Aragorn anymore until beyond the world, theoretically. But, you know, that's theoretically, right? You know, plus, she's already said goodbye to her dad and father and everything, which is why we're doing it now, because you just said this was the last time she saw her dad was in Rohan here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, they're in Minas Tirith. Aragorn, he passes off the crown of Gondor and scepter of Arnor to his son, Eldarion. Yeah, that's his name. Mm-hmm. And then he lays down on his deathbed and he says goodbye to Arwen, who still really can't get over that it's the end of, like, this is all coming to an end now. And she's still got to kind of, I mean, she's mortal, but her lifespan's not over yet, right? So she's mm-hmm. got a couple more years. So she's got to endure Aragorn's death and then I don't think kids, but anyways, I don't know. Anyways, something like that. So, couple significant things to talk about, but let's read the end of this in one shot here. So Aragorn starts off, so I'll take it here. He says, "Lady Undumiel, the hour is indeed hard, yet it was made even in the day when we met under the white birches in the garden of Elrond, where none now walk. And on the hill of Cairn Amroth, when we forsook both the shadow and the twilight, this doom we accepted. Take counsel with yourself, beloved, and ask whether you would indeed have me wait until I wither and fall from a high seat, unmanned and witless. Nay, lady, I am the last of the Numenoreans and the latest king of the Elder Days, and to me has been given not only a span thrice that of men of Middle-earth, but also the grace to go at my will and give back the gift. Now, therefore, I will sleep. I speak no comfort to you, for there is no comfort for such pain within the circles of the world. But the uttermost choice is before you, to repent and go to the havens and bear away into the west the memory of our days together, that shall there be evergreen, but never more than a memory, or else to abide the doom of men."
"Nay, dear lord," she said, "that choice is long over. There is now no ship that would bear me hence, and I must indeed abide the doom of men, whether I will or I nill, the loss and the silence. But I say to you, King of the Numenoreans, not till now have I understood the tale of your people and their fall. As wicked fools I scorned them, but I pitied them at last. For if this is indeed, as the Eldar say, the gift of the One to men, it is bitter to receive."
"So it seems," he said, "but let us not be overthrown at the final test. Who of old renounced the shadow and the ring? In sorrow we must go, but not in despair. Behold, we are not bound forever to the circles of the world, and beyond them is more than memory. Farewell."
"Estelle, Estelle," she cried, and with that, even as he took her hand and kissed it, he fell into sleep. Then a great beauty was revealed in him, so that all who after came there looked on him in wonder. For they saw that the grace of his youth and the valor of his manhood and the wisdom and majesty of his age were blended together. And long there he lay, an image of the splendor of kings of men, in glory undimmed before the breaking of the world. But Arwen went forth from the house, and the light of her eyes was quenched, and it seemed to her people that she had become cold and gray as nightfall in winter that comes without a star. Then she said farewell to Eldarion, and to her daughters, and to all whom she had loved. And she went out from the city of Minas Tirith, and passed away to the land of Lorien, and dwelt there alone under the fading trees until winter came. Galadriel had passed away, and Celeborn also was gone, and the land was silent. There at last, when the Malorn leaves were falling, but spring had not yet come, she laid herself to rest upon Cairn Amroth, and there is her green grave until the world is changed, and all the days of her life are utterly forgotten by men that come after, and Elenor and Nifredel bloom no more east of the sea. Here ends this tale, as it has come to us from the south, and with the passing of Evenstar, no more is said in the book of the days of old."
All right, so that's the deaths of Aragorn and Arwen.
Super sad.
Feelings on that? Yeah, that is sad. Yeah. I mean, it's not super sugar-coated at all.
No.
Right? So, all right, so let's just get into the specifics a little bit here. Okay, so if you remember, so back to the elves dying. If you remember, even when the elves are slain, they actually, their spirits actually go back to Valinor, to the Mandos, who's the Undertaker kind of Valar or god, you know? And it's kind of hazy, but their spirit's definitely there, and the elves in Valinor could definitely go talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Slash, it's not fully fleshed out by Tolkien, but potentially they could reincarnate their bodies and just walk around Valinor.
The Undying Lands is...
Yeah.
Kind of a place of death in a way, right?
Well, no, I mean, it's like heaven on earth, and but like better than like a fake heaven on earth. It's a pretty real heaven on earth. But then,
yeah.
But that's the thing. That's only for elves. Men, they go to Mandos, but then they go somewhere else that is literally beyond the world, right? That's the key. And so all elves, they go to Mandos and they, you know, they're back in Valinor and I don't know, potentially they can hang out. Except to Luthien, who chose to be immortal, and she went the same way as Beren, right? And then now Arwen. Okay, so they both died indeed, right? And so they're parted forever. So like when she said bye to Elrond, her dad, that was forever. Elrond has to live with it. She has to see all of her mortal family. Well, I guess it's mostly Aragorn. Right, I mean, I don't know. There's some more in the kingdom, I guess, but it's like, it's mostly Aragorn. Like, your kids outlived you, so that wasn't that bad. Anyway, she dies in Lothlorien there. So yeah, so it's sad, but
and it's kind of like, it wasn't like a prophecy, or it was her fate that she wasn't really going to die until she saw everything she loved come to an end.
Yeah, yeah, and it wasn't
just that she chose mortality. It was right, that she but was choosing mortality and witnessing the end of these things that you wouldn't witness as an elf.
But that's also what Aragorn kind of harped on, like, hey, we signed up for this. Like, you knew what we were signing up for, and I did too, and I said, like, you gotta make this choice. you made this choice here. But and Arwen even says too, it's like, yeah, I can't go to Valinor now. Like, Aragorn almost seemed like on his deathbed seemed to think, like, I don't know, if you can get a ship over there, I guess you could live with the elves. And she's like, no, I can't. And it's like, all right, well, don't screw up now. But all right, so that's kind of Arwen. But what about Aragorn here? Because I don't know. He's, no offense to Arwen, he's more interesting. Plus, he's the guy we know way better.
Right.
All right. So here's what I was thinking. Well, first of all, it explicitly says it there. You remember the coolest kings in the good kings in Numenor, they could basically, they knew when their lifespan was up. And so then they could just kind of peacefully, basically like die in their sleep or whatever, or just relinquish life in their sleep. So Aragorn gets that power, which is awesome. Good job on him. But it's, I don't know, it's kind of like a weird death where like even Aragorn doesn't quite know what's gonna happen. It's like, yeah, I can't give you any comfort in the confines of this world at least, but there's something beyond this world. What does he say exactly? He said beyond them, that is the walls of the world, there's more than memory, farewell. But that's it, you know. So it's like, what exactly is that? Because again, remember, these guys are like, even Aragorn, as kingly as he is, as type of Christ the King he is, he's still a noble pagan too, right? So there's no super hopeful Christian theology yet, right? So I don't know. It's like a little bit of a downer death, and Tom Shippey especially was like kind of harping on that in his books and everything. But what do you think?
Yeah, it's kind of the, it's like the grandest, how to put it? It's one of the only deaths, I think, that we come across in the books. A death of a mortal that really contemplates the beyond part, or where Tolkien to it, right?
That's
like
true.
All the other deaths we have are like, it's like Gandalf not really dying, kind of being reincarnated, or the elves passing away, or men just dying and having, like, you know, funerary rites performed. This is like one of the only times that Tolkien kind of tries to weave in what is actually beyond, and the fact that Aragorn like sees something great and he's moved to joy and beauty or something in his final sleep, which is kind of interesting. But all told, a fine send off for a mortal, which ultimately Aragorn is.
Yeah. All right. And so then now, why I think this perfectly fits with the chapter that we're doing right now. There's like those lines where Aragorn says, I'm the last of the Numenoreans and the latest king of Elder Days. Heavy, heavy, heavy feelings of transition from like last king of legend on the edge of history, kind of like King Arthur or something.
Right.
And now we're transitioning or ushering in our real historical world. Like we even talked about that with the tell-all special with Gandalf, like, how it's like lessons, but it becomes more realistic. You know, like you have the most elemental gods, then you get the classic gods, and then it becomes like demigods are, you know, revolve in most of the stories, and then it's regular men. You know, it's there's definitely, it's not, I wouldn't say it's not fully fleshed out, but because it's not supposed to be, but like that's what Tolkien's definitely working in with the age of men. Like as the elves fade away, like men are supposed to inherit and come to dominate the world, and that definitely is supposed to be like real history men. Like that's what this is supposed to transition or lead into, you know. Arwen too, she goes to Lothlorien and what?
Well, it's, passes, I mean, away there.
Right. Well, yeah, she passes away there, but like the place itself just isn't, has the withered, same, right?
Right, right. It's no longer magical, basically.
Right. And why is that?
Galadriel and Celeborn are gone and the power of the rings is gone.
Right, correct. So the three elven rings have left 120 years later. By this point, they are gone, right? Mm-hmm. So that's sad. So this is so this, you know, this brings to mind lots of token lines that we've referenced, like the real fairy tales never really end, right? So that's one of the famous things he says. History's one long defeat. We've talked about that one a ton. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I've tried to harp that, like, these catastrophe moments that we had, most notably the destroying of the ring and then the whole, like, two chapters of party afterwards, you know, are like, well, they're signposts of what's going to come at the end of time. But again, like Tolkien said, like the real story just keeps going. And that is actually what we're seeing with this chapter. And that's part of the reason I think it's so long. And despite all the many goodbyes and everything, you know, anyways, I thought, it perfectly fits with this, the mood of this chapter and even the, I don't know, the plot chapter, I guess, you know, but it's here that the waterfall of partings really begins, right? So Faramir, Imrahil, and Arwen, they're going to stay behind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Arwen parting, I don't really get why Imrahil and Faramir wouldn't keep going to see the Ents, because they haven't seen Ents. Yeah. Why would you not pass up the opportunity? Besides that they might have business in Gondor, but...
Yeah, I feel like it fits better with what you were saying about it's like peeling back the layers in the same way that they were added. Or like the opposite of the many meetings. They can't extend too far beyond where they were introduced to the story.
Yeah, yeah, potentially. All right, but then Eowyn and Eomir, they're also saying goodbye, even though Aragorn's just going to walk around their whole kingdom. Not that they don't trust him, but it's like, what? I thought you would escort him, but whatever. All right, anyways, Eomir and Eowyn say goodbye, particularly to Merry, and they give him a really sweet gift. Because they're trying to figure out what's the most fitting thing we can give him and what will he accept too. So they decide on giving him this really cool horn. And, you know, they want it to be a memory of the horns blowing on the Pelennor field when the riders charged in. As if anybody can forget that scene. But, do you want to read the description of the horn? I thought it was worth the read, even though this is a long chapter.
Then Eowyn gave to Merry an ancient horn, small but cunningly wrought, all of fair silver with a baldric of green, and Wight's head engraven upon it, swift horsemen riding in a line that wound about it from the tip to the mouth, and there were set runes of great virtue. This is an heirloom of our house, said Eowyn. It was made by the dwarves and came from the hoard of Scatha the Worm. Eorl the Young brought it from the north. He that blows it at need shall set fear in the hearts of his enemies and joy in the hearts of his friends, and they shall hear him and come to him. Then Merry took the horn, for it could not be refused, and he kissed Eowyn's hand, and they embraced him, and so they parted for that time.
Oh, all right, awesome. They, especially when it's Rohan people, very Beowulfian to give gifts, you know? we almost even said in the Beowulf special, like, it's like receipts of friendships.
Right.
But anyways, one of the Rohan or North people before them must have killed a dragon named Scatha, is what I kind of gather from that. Kind of cool. All right, but we got to keep moving on now. So those are some goodbyes. I can't even count how many goodbyes there are in this chapter, but I think that's five major characters bye that we said.
Yeah. So, all right. Yeah.
All right, anyways, then we go Helm's Deep. Legolas and Gimli, they go see the glittering caves behind there, because remember they had their pact that if they made it through, Legolas would see the glittering caves, and then Gimli would have to go to Fangorn, right?
Uh-huh.
And Legolas is pretty funny. Funny detail that Legolas is left speechless coming out of it, which is probably the first time in history that a dwarf is more articulate than an elf.
Yes.
Because also don't forget that Gimli had a phenomenal description of those caves after the Helm's Deep chapter. It was pretty awesome. So definitely worth the reread even. But yeah. All right. So they get to Isengard next. And the Ents have changed it into Isengarden. Oh, how about that pun?
That's actually really, that's interesting etymology by Tolkien's part, because guard, I think, literally relates to like,
oh, the wall
fortress or like walling something in. And then garden is like that which is walled, which separates it from nature. So it's like the walled space kind of.
Cool. I've heard like, you know, like, so the most famous gardens, like Garden of Eden, like there's an idea that it was a walled garden too. Like none of us would think of that, but like in the ancient world, like you had the garden, I think, in the center of the castle.
Right. It was like defined by its walls. Otherwise it would be just forest or field or something.
Yeah. All right. Anyways, here's a description of it. All the stone circle had been thrown down and removed, and the land within was made into a garden filled with orchards and trees, and a stream ran through it. But in the midst of all, there was a lake of clear water, and out of the tower, Orthanc rose still, and tall and impregnable, and its black rock was mirrored in the pool. All right. So just thought it was worth the read. Anyways, they go and speak to Treebeard. They congratulate and thank him for all his help, all the help, and Treebeard also congratulates Gandalf too, you know. So Treebeard also he explicitly says that they didn't just deal with Saruman, they had to stop a bunch of orcs from crossing the Anduin into Rohan, and Galadriel and Celeborn also helped stave off those orcs too. So like when the whole Rohan army left to go to Gondor, they were kind of scared, like, hey, do we have enough people to guard? Hey, there might be enemies coming from the north. And Éomer, at that point, there's a line, and you can go back and find it. There's a line in the chapter. Éomer's like, too late. We got to push on. No time to worry. We got to go. We got to go. We're committed, you know? So, anyways, Treebeard, he calls, what does he call orcs?
Evil-eyed, black-handed, bow-legged, flint-hearted, claw-fingered, foul-bellied, bloodthirsty, Mori Metasin Kahanda. Their full name is as long as years of torment.
So, as soon as I read that, I was like, this prompts a reprisal of what I think is one of our favorite games, probably my favorite game that we've done. We're going to do some end sentences, Clifford. And that gets back to, like, I think this is the best occasion that arises. You brought up how cool you think it is that everything's on different timelines in these books. And, like, they're all just meeting in, like, this one small time period in this story. And, I mean, like, this is probably one of the longest, you know, kind of personal timelines any character has when they're showing up here, which is also fun.
Right. And we hear that reflected in the language, is I guess what I'm trying to say. Like, his language reflects the fact that he sees the world in a different timeline.
Right. But just to get, like, more acquainted with this language, because I think that's such a cool idea that it's just, like, you know, all your memories of something, that's just your word for it. I thought it'd be kind of fun just to make our own sentences for that. I don't know if you had time to, but I got like two examples here, and like I might just have you guess.
Okay, yeah, that sounds great.
The talented foolish one with the jacket and the beret and the vest of the fast animal did not go to the place of many rooms and many peoples with the metal cabinets and the slow talking aged person who uses glass to see, talking about witchcraft and supply and demand, who was calling the name of this one who was ill to the ones who produced him, but to the one whose sire had the fast machine with no roof. For these rebellious pupils went to the tall building of many stacks, and the place where ivy grows and the young bears play, and to the place of many fine pictures and the statues, and to the long procession where there was much twisting and shouting.
Man, that's a good job just off the bat. Like, that's a nice thing you made. Okay, we've got the Cubs in there playing at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, and with the ivy.
Yeah, we've got...
I'm saying that for people playing along who might not know this.
Yeah. I don't know if I know my Cubs history well enough to say who's the character in the beret with the...
Well, you're off if you think it's the Cubs.
Okay.
I'll give you that hint.
Okay, so we've got a guy with a beret and a jacket, and he...
What's the vest of the Fast End?
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, nice job, Uncle Vern.
Leopard print vest. To be sung, bells to be rung, wonderful fling to be flung. And even when I'm old and gray, I'm gonna feel the way I do today. 'Cause you make me feel so young.
I believe you prepared yours, right?
Yes, I have.
All right, you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay. I got to guess. Just for context, if you guys don't remember the first time we played this, it was in the Treebeard chapter. You can go listen to those. It's a hoot. Maybe I'll actually clip in my best one from that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Ferris Bueller one for future Patrick's reference. Anyways, this game is like... You can play along with us. Hopefully Clifford did something that people could play along with, but maybe he didn't. But it's pretty difficult, you know, as you do it. And then you hear the answer and it's like, oh, yeah, this all makes sense. You know, if you re-listen to it.
Okay, I will caveat and admit I didn't stumble on a clever... Mine's not like a common saying.
Okay.
Or a phrase that I've converted. It's more of a... Oh. It's more narrative.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Hopefully it's not too long.
Not too long.
Well, the narrative's not too long. If your sentence takes forever, because by sentence these are like a paragraph. Mine's a solid paragraph.
Okay.
All right, Clifford. Yeah, you go for it. Here we go.
While this same sun was still higher in the sky, I traveled south along the great water to the home of lore masters upon a hill amidst great grand red friends of mine. But you're in such a hurry, I'm getting carried away. After the days grow shorter and begin to lengthen again, I shall leave this humble place where I now rest at nights to travel to a place somewhat like this home of the lore masters on the hill amidst great friends of mine, so that I might read and share words with some who know more of the workings and history of the world than myself. And then, well, I have not the powers of foresight to speak of what shall come to pass after this.
Okay. I know, all right, I think I got most of this. So you're, well, it helps that I know, like, I think the context of your life right now. Anyways, you're going to go to your grad school on a hill.
Okay.
Right? That's mm-hmm. what's on the hill, the Lure Masters on a hill, that's the university, mm-hmm. right? And then after the days get shorter, so that's winter, and then they get longer again, so spring, so you're going to be done in, like, 9 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever.
I realized I made a mistake there, but yes, you're right.
Okay, so anyways, and then you're gonna go to another place of lore masters. So you're gonna go to another college or something.
Pretty close. I realized I made a mistake there. I switched longer and shorter on accident.
I still picked up what you meant.
Okay, so the quick thing is. Today, randomly for work, I went down to UC Santa Cruz for like site visit. It's set amongst the redwoods near the ocean.
Mm.
But I'm going to be going to grad school soon, most likely, at a different place, also on a hill, also with redwoods, and gonna study.
Okay, I don't know how it's supposed to. Yeah, I don't know how it's supposed to know these colleges are on a hill. That's really hard.
I know. That's what I realized. I was like, this is maybe not so clever. It's just difficult. And then after that, I don't know what the future holds. So that's where I leave it.
Well, okay.
What was yours? Right.
Okay. Context. This should be applicable for hopefully everybody.
Okay.
All right. And again. Now, when I did the last one, the Ferris Bueller one, I thought I was making it easy, but like Clifford struggled mightily, and that wasn't his fault. It's just like kind of hard to do. But like after, like you said, you reread that one. Like,
if you know what's coming, it's very easy. But
right,
trying to pull it out of nowhere, it's really hard.
Yeah. All right, so I had to really do some syntax stuff with this one too to make sure that I read this so that it makes sense too. All right, but anyways, here I go. The man whose weapons are his hands sprouted and grew tall in the forest of skyscrapers known for delicious ingredients shoved between bread, and strong bonds of admiration shared between those with common fathers. And he was portrayed by the showman whose parents called him, the name corresponding to the moving drawing that chases the small yellow flying creature. This portrayed southpaw is of descent from the boot-shaped land that helps form the first part of his rhyming nickname, the second part of which is the most magnificent of the four-legged beasts that men ride upon. This most solid-named hero is accompanied with instruments playing an arrangement of melodies that so pumps the blood, he is able to punch carcasses of ice and run up many stairs in preparation for the single combat contest in the square that is bordered with bouncing strings. Against the man of belief, the man who shares a name with the day lamp god and with the flying fire exploders that visited the faraway lamp for the land when most creatures sleep.
Okay, Rocky Balboa, portrait, or he's in Philadelphia, training to be a boxer, portrayed by Sylvester Stallone.
Right.
And then I lost you a little bit, but he's then gearing up, training.
Right.
To fight the Russian guy, right?
No. So you got the... All right, so the part where I lost you was his nickname's the Italian Stallion. So boot-shaped land is Italy. And then horse is like most magnificent's a stallion, right? So, okay. So anyways, that was that. Just
what was
in case
the painting and the fly?
Oh, the drawing. Yeah, Sylvester the cat, the Looney Tunes cat, chases Tweety Bird, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, then he's got the theme song that's the blood pumping, right? And then he mm-hmm. punches the ice and he runs upstairs. And
right,
awesome.
Right. That,
I was rewatching it. I had the YouTube video of it just on repeat as I was writing that. All right, and then he has single combat, but who does he have to face? He's training to face.
I don't know why I'm mixing it. I can't. I'm all thinking right. of the later ones all right. with like the Russian. Yeah,
the man of belief, the man who shares a name with the day lamp god and with the flying fire exploders that visited the faraway lamp for the land when most creatures sleep. So that last part's the easy thing. What's the flying fire exploder that visits the faraway lamp when the land sleeps?
Flying fire exploder?
That visits the faraway lamp. What's the faraway lamp?
Faraway lamp?
The faraway lamp for the land when most creatures sleep.
Moon.
Okay, so the fire exploder's what?
Okay. Rocket?
Right. Okay, which rocket? What's
Apollo.
What series went?
Apollo
okay,
Creed.
So what's right, so belief means creed, right?
Right. Okay.
So anyway, yeah. So it's Rocky the Italian Stallion training to fight Apollo Creed.
Gotcha. Okay. Well done.
Cue the music.
Well done.
All right, that was fun, but
I like your descriptions. Those were really, really good.
Yeah, I was having trouble picking out what to do this time because the Ferris Bueller one was fun, and I wanted to do something like that. And I was like, oh, Rocky Balboa and Apollo Creed. There's like so many like, you know, those names you can play with stuff and like, you know, describe like keep breaking down the description of that because that's the whole point of the end sentences is that they just keep describing stuff, and it's all like. Almost experiential or mm-hmm. you know super detailed based off experience, and that's just the noun for it, you know. All right, but anyways, Aragorn says the end's part will never be forgotten in Rohan and Gondor, and Treebeard tells him, oh, pump the brakes, dude. Never's a really long time.
Yeah.
Maybe as long as your kingdom lasts, I guess. I don't know. But Gandalf also adds to add this transition idea. He says, like, well, the kings of men might, you know, in this new age might even outlast you Ents.
Mm-hmm.
And Did Treebeard agree with that? I don't remember what he wrote.
I think he did. He said he did respond to it.
Oh no, Gandalf immediately cuts him off and starts talking about
Saruman. Oh yeah. Okay, Saruman. But it's a kind of interesting twist. Like, Gandalf's basically like, time is not what you have known for so long. Time is something different now.
Well, I mean, it's like, I think it like really emphasizes like, yeah, this is a finite world. Treebeard, he's a living thing, which means he's going to die. He's going to fade away at some point. Yeah, to reinforce like that the fairy tales, real fairy tales never end, and they all kind of have sad ends in this world, you know? But then it's like, there is all this talk this chapter about what's beyond this world and stuff too. So who knows there? Hopefully it's happier. Christian view would say it's happier, I guess. Mm-hmm. All right. Treebeard, it's at this point that he drops the bomb that, you know, he just let Saruman go, which is a really comical idea, right? Because that was like one of his few jobs that he was actually asked to do was to guard Saruman.
Right.
But he was talking to Saruman often, and Saruman endured it because he wanted news really bad. And Treebeard says he could not get news any other way, and though he hated the news, he was greedy to have it. Thoughts on that? I have a couple.
Well, Saruman obviously is just, you can tell he's like fiending for information. He wants to know about the world, but he previously was able to see everything with his Palantir. Being like the once Saruman the wise, no longer the wise, but clearly loves knowledge. That's like his obsession. So wants to know everything about everything. So it's like his lifeblood is knowledge of things. So it makes total sense that he's greedy for it.
Yeah. So what I was thinking was, he sounded like a couple people that were trapped in Dante's Inferno. So that's hell, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. And so the one that I'm thinking of in particular, I don't know, they were like basically political animals, like political faction machines, you know, like they were the head of their political party or whatever. And they devoted their whole life to it. And it was like, oh, I don't know. They really devoted their whole life to it. And it's like, they're in hell because like that was their life as opposed to something higher than that, you know? And so like, I almost felt like this guy struck me because it's like Farinata is his name, because that one's like, wow, he actually did some objectively good things. It's just, he didn't have his priorities straight at all. And so now he's stuck here. And so one of the things about him was, he doesn't know what's going on in the present with his political party and everything.
Interesting.
So, like, he knows the whole past and everything, but he doesn't get to know the present. So like, he's desperate for news, you know. I don't know. It definitely reminded me of Saruman here.
Huh.
And the other thing, we mentioned this too when we were talking about Gollum and destroying the ring and everything. But like, Saruman now, especially, it's going to be even more obvious with him. He's sending himself to hell, or, you know, making his own hell for himself by his own hatred, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As we'll see, it's like, he could be repentant, doesn't choose to be. And he's just, you know, a stick in the mud, and his life sucks because of it, you know? Mm-hmm. So let's keep going here, because we were doing good. Now we're doing just average on time.
Uh-huh.
All right, anyways, Treebeard felt bad for Saruman because he was so cooped up. But he figured he wasn't a menace anymore, so he's like, I'll just let him go. And the line is, a snake without fangs may crawl where he will. And Gandalf says, you might be right, but this snake still had one tooth left, I think. And that's his enchanting voice, because it seems to have fooled you, Treebeard. Come on, dude. Mm-hmm. But Treebeard, he gives the keys of Orthanc to Aragorn. Aragorn gives the valley to the Ents. All right. And then it's finally time to say goodbye to Legolas and Gimli, who are going to go home via Fangorn Forest to balance out the pact with the Glittering Caves, right?
Right.
So Aragorn says, here then at last comes the ending of the Fellowship of the Ring. But I hope you guys come and visit. <Basically, you know? laughs> What does Gimli say?
So Gimli basically says he plans to, and he says, we'll send word when we may, and some of us may yet meet at times, but I fear that we shall not all be gathered together ever again.
And he's right. Very bittersweet. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of like soldiers parting after war, you know, after the war's won.
Yeah.
The one that came to my mind right away was Lafayette. He was the cool French guy in the Revolutionary War with George Washington.
Uh-huh.
And so he had like snuck over before any of the French were openly in alliance with the United States.
Uh-huh.
And so he becomes like, George Washington really does become like a father to him, kind of like how, I don't know, Théoden was a father to Mary, I guess, for like the week, you know, but right, like right. For Lafayette, it's like 10 years with Washington or whatever. And so when they parted, like Lafayette, you know, because he had to go back to France, is like, I'm pretty damn sure this is going to be the last time I ever see George Washington. And it's like, I don't know. It is that level of parting here, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Lesser examples like championship teams or dynasties finally breaking apart in like sports or something, you mm-hmm. know, but I don't know. There's lots of ways to relate to this one, I'd say, right?
Agreed.
And I think everybody can, even personally. One thing that I've started like saying mostly to myself recently, but but I've said it to other people too, is like, man, all good things must come to an end, like this side of the eschaton, which are like the end times, you know, which would be
right,
like,
right.
Tolkien's kind of final end. It's like, yeah, you know, it's been great, but they know they have to all break up for good reasons too, but it's like still sad at the end. But like you're saying, this is mostly a happy chapter too, even though it is, I don't know,
right,
and,
right.
It's good and bad.
It's weirdly upbeat in spite of the fact that it's all these goodbyes and final farewells.
And it's goodbyes on good terms, you know?
Right.
Like, they actually are goodbyes. You know? Yes. It's not just bye.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. All right. Oh, there's this one weird line, passage that I just want to read just because it's weird. I don't know if I fully get it. So I'll take it here. I'll start it at least. Then Treebeard said farewell to each of them in turn, and he bowed three times slowly and with great reverence to Celeborn and Galadriel. Why don't you take it? Because you're Treebeard.
It is long, long since we met by stock or by stone. Avanimar, Avanimaliand, Nostari, he said. It is sad that we shall meet only thus at the ending, for the world is changing. I feel it in the water, I feel it in the earth, and I smell it in the air. I do not think we shall meet again.
And Celeborn said, I do not know, eldest. But Galadriel said, not in Middle-earth, nor until the lands that lie under the wave are lifted up again. Then in the Willowmeads of Tanassarin, we may yet meet in the spring. Farewell. All right. The lands washed under by the wave.
Numenor?
First thing that comes to mind
for me.
Right. So it's Numenor, but then it's also all of Beleriand, where like the Silmarillion happened. So this is the really confusing thing that none of the books fleshed out for me. I don't know if Tolkien ever really fleshed out himself, but he definitely had at some point, and I thought he abandoned it, but he had at some point the idea right before the end of time, you know, like the real end of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or like history's over. Morgoth would escape back into the world. Like he would somehow get past Arendil's guard, you know, because Arendil's guarding him in the boat above, you know?
Mm-hmm,
with the Sumeril. So he'd get past that, there'd be a big climactic battle, you know, like the final battle, right, where Morgoth is defeated for right. good, and then at that point the world is remade, like what they're saying, like I guess like the lands that are washed under the wave are lifted up,
right?
And then at that point too, even like the Silmarils will be recollected all three together, and Fëanor himself, you know, and we did a whole special about Fëanor. It was a while ago, but like Fëanor, not the nicest guy in the world. But anyways, Fëanor himself would take the three jewels and he would give them over freely to the gods to recreate the two trees, which was like the original most heavenly light in Valinor and everything. So like everything would kind of be recreated.
Interesting.
But I just don't, but I don't understand how that fits with like men are leaving beyond the world. So it's like, what? Are the elves just going to have this world? Like, and it's going to be the real thing? Or do men like, is that when like, the Christian heaven bursts into the world or something, I don't know, you know,
interesting,
it's hazy,
interesting.
but that has to be what that's a reference to, you know.
I feel like he's got these concepts of the end times and the ending of the world, and then at points he's clarified it more in your kind of noble pagan lineage where he's like, he's consolidating it better with Christian theology, but in other, like maybe in earlier formations, it was not so separate between men and elves, and the idea of like the remaking at the end of the world was like not a foreign concept to Middle Earth. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's not going to be a definitive answer that we can give on that one, you know.
I also wonder, like it sounds like the world is being unmade or remade, and then also I thought like, there's maybe a physical thing, like if Beleriand comes out of the water, would allow Treebeard to physically walk back to Valinor. Like, he couldn't get to Valinor now unless he was got put on a boat, which sounds...
He had never been to Valinor, but the original place he hung out in was Beleriand.
Oh, where's Tsarinan?
That's,
In Beleriand somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Meet in the spring. I don't know. Spring is also, like, new life, rebirth
well, yeah,
type thing, so...
Well, that's the sign that it's, like, everything's remade, you know?
Mm-hmm. Or I wonder... It's almost like it's said so randomly in this conversation that it's almost like, I wonder if it's like, what's the proper term? If it's almost like an epithet for the elves and the ents, like they both understand it to be something almost impossible.
Well, I think this is stuff that happens beyond the long defeat part of Tolkien's quote. Like, I'm pretty convinced
I guess
of
so.
That.
Okay.
I don't know. It's...
I don't know. But I feel like you could read it as Galadriel saying, like, yep, this is the last time, unless the world were to, like, wind itself backwards or something like that. You know, she might be saying it offhandedly like that as a way to say goodbye forever. Because you could interpret it that way, that she's saying, we did meet in the spring of the Willamedes of Tsarinan long ago. And the lands were above the waves. And it's like, we're not going to meet in Middle Earth, nor until like the world is undone or something like that. Like if you kind of paraphrased it. So anyways.
Yeah. I don't know.
Many readings, but yeah, it's a peculiar little passage.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So Merry and Pippin, they have one last end draft of, with Treebeard, and that's what made him grow tall. I remember.
Right. They're going to be giants for when they get back to the Shire.
Oh, they will be. But Treebeard's last words to him is, look out for the ent wives. You know, if you find them, let me know. Right. Send the word. All right. And then they leave. Go back down the river Isen. They get towards the Gap of Rohan, and we come to what is probably, in my opinion, for me, the saddest parting, and has been since the first time I ever read these books. You want to start it?
Sure. The travelers now rode with more speed, and they made their way towards the Gap of Rohan, and Aragorn took leave of them at last, close to the very place where Pippin had looked into the Stone of Orthanc. The hobbits were grieved at this parting, for Aragorn had never failed them, and he had been their guide through many perils. "I wish we could have a stone that we could see all of our friends in," said Pippin, "and that we could all speak to them from far away."
"Only one now remains that you could use," answered Aragorn, "for you would not wish to see what the stone of Minas Tirith would show you. But the Palantir of Orthanc the king will keep, to see what is passing in his realm and what his servants are doing. For do not forget, Peregrin Took, that you are a knight of Gondor, and I do not release you from your service. You are going now on leave, but I may recall you. And remember, dear friends of the Shire, that my realm lies in the north, and I shall come there one day."
Then Aragorn took leave of Celeborn and Galadriel, and the lady said to him, "Elfstone, through darkness you have come to your hope, and have now all your desire. Use well the days." But Celeborn said, "Kinsman, farewell. May your doom be other than mine, and your treasure remain with you to the end."
With that, they parted, and it was then the time of sunset. And when, after a while, they turned and looked back, they saw the King of the West sitting upon his horse with his knights about him, and the falling sun shone upon them and made all their harnesses to gleam like red gold, and the white mantle of Aragorn was turned to a flame. Then Aragorn took the green stone and held it up, and there was a green fire from his hand. That is goodbye to our king.
Ugh. Yes.
Seriously, I remember the first time I ever read it. It's like, oh, this is like Pride Rock, Bambi mountaintop end, you know? Uh-huh. like Lion King, Bambi, you know, because Lion King ends with them standing on the rock, right? And then Bambi, more so Bambi for me, he stands on the rock looking over the forest with his dad, but then his dad leaves and it's like, yeah, I'm retired. You're the garter now, you know, but he's looking over everything. It's just the real fairy tales never come to an end, but like at least this is a fairy tale send off for now, you would say.
Right.
Good news, though. He's king of Gondor and Arnor. Man mm-hmm. of the North. He will return someday, rebuild there. Pretty excellent. Pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also thought this potentially could have been the end of the chapter, too, honestly.
Yeah, easily.
Yeah. I wish it was now that we're 75 minutes in.
Oh, man. This is one question I had. Why did Aragorn's like says it kind of almost in a spooky way. Like, you don't wish to see what the Stone of Minas Tirith would show you. What is he referring to there?
Denethor's hands are imprinted on it. Like, because it was okay. burned with him. And so, like, yeah, there's lines about you'll that see, in that like, chapter. You'll
see, like, Denethor's death almost if you look into the stone.
Yeah, that's what they said. Like, if any, because they have it recovered, but, and they said, like, yeah, if you look at this, you're going to see, like, the agony of him holding it at the end. Yeah. So that's a no-no. All right, so they go through the Gap of Rohan, and they turn north towards Rivendell. A week on the way, they come to an old man leaning on a staff, and he was clothed in rags of gray or dirty white, and at his heels was another beggar slouching and whining. This is, of course...
Saruman and Wormtongue.
Yeah, okay, so Fleming Rutledge has this good quote here, and this helps develop something, too. There's still 50 pages left to go in this book, right? The party travels at leisure, relishing the last golden days of autumn. It is a measure of Tolkien's inventiveness and storytelling gifts, however, that he has some surprises still left for us. Moreover, he is letting us know that there is no real leisure in this life, not for any real duration, okay? Again, like she said, 50 pages left. This also starts to really reinforce... Just because the ring's destroyed doesn't mean evil's totally gone, too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. they there's the falling action, the fairy tales continue, right? So, like, that's the whole point, I think, of why the ending to Lord of the Rings is a dragged out 100 pages, you know?
Right.
Like, it's he's neatly wrapping up all the storylines, but it's also like, yeah, things go on even past the destruction of the ring. That wasn't the end all be all, even if it kind of was in Gondor, but. All right, but anyway, Saruman, we don't have to read much of this conversation. Saruman's spiteful, but Gandalf, like, he doesn't try to arrest him or anything or even control him. He just offers him help. And Gandalf, like, he says, like, well, my mission's complete. And Saruman, if you had stayed at Orthanc, Aragorn could have shown you mercy and wisdom and pardoned you or whatever, which mm-hmm. Saruman, he's disgusted by that, right? And then Galadriel starts talking to him, and he's even more spiteful towards her. Because he thinks she never trusted him, which she didn't. Saruman's only consolation is that he knows that with the ring's destruction, so the power of the Elven rings is done, and they have to sail across the sea. He says, "It will afford me some comfort that as I wander, to think that you pulled down your own house when you destroyed mine." All right, what do you think of that line?
It's pretty interesting. It's like. Well, he's basically saying that you undid the power of the Elven rings at the same time that you undid the One Ring, which was the source of all this evil
right.
power. But it's kind of like, it's like a leveling thing. It's like you decided to level the earth down to, like, it's, I almost read it as like, in the original creation, there was good and evil still. Right? Like, evil existed in some fashion, technically. It just hadn't built up any power. Right? Okay. And that's kind of what the destruction of the ring did, is like it leveled everything back to this like base level of power and good and evil, where evil still exists, but it doesn't have its built up army and fortress and everything.
Mm.
So it's almost like Saruman's like, at least I can be grateful that like I haven't been totally vanquished or something like that, but that you had to undo your own power to undo mine. But it's
you focused on the exact opposite part of the quote that I focused on.
All right. Sorry, go ahead.
So I was interested more like, it will afford me some comfort. All right, what? Uh-huh. Like, so he's going to have comfort that, you know, you guys self-sacrificed to destroy the ring. Because, like, they knew that was the game the whole time. It's like,
right,
the three are going to fade when we do this, but we're willing to do it, right? That was the whole brave thing that they've had. The mission since the Council of Elrond, that they were going to do it, and they've done it. And then Saruman says, I find comfort in that. That's just so petty, first of all.
Right.
And then, so, like, again, like, you know, you're trapped in your hell of your own making at this point. You know, like, he's living it right now in life. He hasn't even died yet, but it's like he's already in hell. You know, like, he's just dealing with problem after problem. And so, like, this one, I think, is this is envy. You know, like, mm-hmm. seven deadly sins. This is envy, because that's when you're upset at other people's good fortune, and you're also about happy about other people's misfortune, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, this would be mm-hmm. the second one here, right? And I've also heard envy described as the dumbest of the seven deadly sins because it doesn't get you anywhere. Like, you get nothing out of it. Like,
you just that's have, very interesting.
Yeah, it's funny too.
Yeah.
But I, you know, like, as soon as you hear that, you know, it's like, oh, this one's just dumb. It's like, well, that's a reason to never be envious again, even though, I don't know, everybody kind of naturally is at points, but you try to beat that out of yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess. But, and I don't know, like, those kinds of examples, I think, help to do it. Anyways, Grima was with him. He sounds a lot like Gollum at this point. Plus, he's got his slave master visibly next to him, and he's treating him openly like dirt. Mm-hmm. So Gandalf, he openly invites Grima, just leave Saruman. Like, you don't have to put up with this crap, right? But he doesn't, out of fear, is what it says. And so this is another Grima, another case, hell of, like, his own perpetuation at this point, at the least, you know? Because it's mm-hmm. like, I don't know, he could just leave Saruman, but maybe the unknown's scary.
Right, or I think it's like
the rehabilitation process might be tough, you know, so you don't want to do it.
Like, right, or if you're, like, so this. Corrupted, the idea of goodness is repulsive.
Yeah.
In a way that's like he
well, this said fear, so, like, he can't understand it or,
right.
I don't know, just intimidated right. by it. Yeah. There's a weird exchange with Saruman mocking him, but then also being a beggar when mm-hmm. Merry offers him his pipeweed. I would just say read that one for yourself, because it was weird.
Yeah, the takeaway I felt like is that Saruman has become basically pathetic. Like, he still yeah. has this power. He's, like, clearly has a history of the coercive voice where he can convince people to do things. Yeah. Now he's almost powerless. So he's, like, his version of groveling is alternating between, oh, pity me and screw you.
Yeah.
I'm the best, you're terrible. And he's just, like, oscillating between that in this vicious, self-destructive way that you just, it's like, it's embarrassing for him, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So
in that, too, there's some weird, ominous talk about the Shire. Sam doesn't uh-huh. really like it, but Saruman and Wormtongue, they just walk off north, and then everybody's just like, all right, whatever. And Frodo says, yeah, I don't really like what he's hinting about it, the Shire too, but either way, I'm going to Rivendell because I want to see Bilbo first, no matter mm-hmm. what. And Gandalf agrees that that's a good idea. All right, so at this point, the group that's left, it's the Hobbits, Gandalf, Elrond, Celeborn, Galadriel, probably a bunch of elves beyond mm-hmm. them, right? Okay, they continue wandering north through very beautiful country until they spy Moria's Three Peaks. And that might have been the site itself. It wasn't even in Moria that made Gimli's eyes, like, smolder, I think. But I could mm-hmm. be wrong. Maybe it was somewhere in there. Or maybe it was both. Anyways, this low-key leads to one of my favorite images or descriptions from all of Lord of the Rings, because it just seeps back all of that nostalgia that just kind of melted over us throughout the whole Fellowship of the Ring about, like, the elves' world fading
mm-hmm,
away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just love it. All right. So if you don't mind, I'm going to start it.
Yeah, go for it.
They were near the gates of Moria. Here now for 7 days they tarried, for the time was at hand for another parting which they were loth to make. Soon Celeborn and Galadriel and their folk would turn eastward and so pass by the Redhorn Gate and come down the Dimrill's Stair to the Silverload and to their own country. They had journeyed thus far by the west ways, for they had much to speak of with Elrond and with Gandalf, and here they lingered still in converse with their friends. Often long after the hobbits were wrapped in sleep, they would sit together under the stars, recalling the ages that were gone and all the joys and labors in the world, or holding counsel concerning the days to come. If any wanderer had chanced to pass, little would he have seen or heard, and it would seem to him only that he saw gray figures, carven in stone, memorials of forgotten things now lost in unpeopled lands. For they did not move or speak with mouth, looking from mind to mind, and only their shining eyes stirred and kindled as their thoughts went to and fro.
But at length all was said, and they parted again for a while, until it was time for the three rings to pass away. Quickly fading into the stones and the shadows, the grey-cloaked people of Lorien rode towards the mountains, and those who were going to Rivendell sat on the hill and watched, until there came out of the gathering mist a flash, and then they saw no more. Frodo knew that Galadriel had held aloft her ring in token of farewell.
Ho 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 ho. So Sam sighed and turned away. But I wish I was going back to Lorien, is what he said. Mm-hmm. But all right. You want to take a guess why that's my favorite, low-key favorite, one of my favorite parts? It's mostly just the lines itself, but like, I don't know, I guess
pick. Yeah, it's a beautiful description, but I think it captures, like, it's, we've talked about a couple times, like a unification of plot and landscape and character almost. Like, it's the sunset, it's the setting of the mountains, everything's turning gray. It's like exactly representative of the elves fading from the world, like this last light.
And then
the flash of the ring is like this last bit, this last glimpse of the beauty and power of the elven rings before they disappear entirely.
And my favorite part too is, I mean, we've done this whole podcast at this point, right?
Right.
One way or another, we've hit every major story Tolkien ever wrote. And Galadriel, we know Gandalf's a Maiar. And Elrond's been around for a good amount of it, and Celeborn's lived with Galadriel for most of it. It's like they've seen almost, especially Galadriel, has seen quite a lot, almost all of it.
Right.
And like now, this really is the end. All right, we got like very little time because these rings are already starting to fade, lose their power because the One Ring's been destroyed. And it's like this is the, yeah, they said the last kind of week where they're just sitting around the campfire, and then it's like, it's not even like, token detail, they're not just sitting around the campfire reminiscing and talking about it. It's like
they just look like stone, you know, memorials. Yeah. And then they're just telecommunicating.
This is, this is like the moment that we're transitioning from the mythology into the present tense almost.
Yeah. Right? Well,
like,
yeah,
we're moving into the only part of the story, or one of the only parts of the story that Galadriel hasn't been around to witness, for instance. Like, as we wrap up these final bits of the chapter and the future chapters, we're extending beyond the storyline of the elves in a way.
Yeah, and it's like once these guys go, real history starts. Like, then we're out of the edge of history. Like, we're still over the edge of history in the weeds, you know, and this is all myth stuff that Tolkien's drawing out or, you know, placing there. But, you know, once these guys leave, then, like, real boring history that, you know, students have to learn in school starts up, you know.
No more elves.
Yeah. All right. Anyways, it said the bearers of the three rings. Do we actually know this? Do we know this? Who have the three rings? We know it probably two.
Galadriel.
All right. Galadriel.
Elrond.
Frodo just said it. Elrond.
And I thought we speculated had the third one.
No, that's not what we speculated. That's the reality. We're not giving that away. So just say, I'm not sure we know about the third one.
I'm not sure we know about the third one.
Right. So the likely guess with the third one would be that it's Círdan, but.
Oh, right. Okay.
That'll be a little maybe.
Okay.
Galadriel. We got a bit more book left. Círdan. Yeah.
Okay.
This is one of the things about the Tell Almost All special. This is part of what made it the Almost All. Not yet.
A little bit of mystery remaining.
Yeah. Might as well milk it out, you know. We got apparently 50 pages of book left. I think it's more like 40, but whatever. All right. This also definitely could have been the end of the chapter, in my opinion. Like, that was a pretty proper send-off, but I don't know. Fleming Rutledge, she has this quote, too, that I thought was great. At length, the hobbits with Gandalf must say farewell to the Lothlorien elves, and the great cloaks ride north. Sam deeply sighs. Most readers will do the same. True. This also, like, I don't know, this was years ago, Patrick, that was planning these outlines, but I put a link to this Wild Mountain Time song. Most people will recognize it, but, like, I think it's more of a summer song, but anyways, it always felt like a fall song to me, and so like this is exactly where this starts like vibing up. This is the version I have played this as like a sober up song at the end of their concert too. So I don't know, I'll probably be clipping that in for the rest of this, but it's pretty excellent.
Okay, I'll take a listen.
Yeah, all right. So anyways, they get back to Rivendell and they see Bilbo, who notes that they came just in time for his birthday. So that means what day is it?
It is
April. Oh god, Clifford, we just said it's fall.
I'm sorry, September. Let's see.
It's the day before it.
September
20th? Close. Alright, so their birthday's September 22nd. Frodo and Bilbo share the birthday.
So
that means it's December 21st when they get here, right?
Okay.
Yeah, and so at this point, Bilbo is not just self-centered about birthdays. He's 129, and the record for a hobbit is 130. So if he lives one more year, he could pass the mark, you know? They talk to Bilbo for a fortnight, which is...
Mm-hmm. 2 weeks?
Yep, about the adventure. But he's too senile to really absorb everything, except Aragorn's wedding, because he knows Aragorn. He had this interesting line, I thought, because he wanted to attend. But he said, but when it came to it, I found I had so much to do here, and packing is such a bother. So that packing is such a bother reminded me of the Leaf by Niggle special that we did.
Mm-hmm.
How Niggle didn't pack for his journey, which was death, you know, and like just kind of came up on him. Like,
right.
I don't know if that's actually a connection. And Bilbo, I think he has actually prepared pretty well for death, but you know.
Right. But yeah, the idea that he's packing and he couldn't go on
for a journey,
definitely foreboding of his the end.
Yeah. All right. So later in this chapter, Bilbo he entrusts the writing of the book to Frodo, and he tells Sam to help him out. And then when you knock things into shape, come on back and I'll run it over and I won't be too critical about it. Don't worry. And he's greater, you know. So, because like he was falling asleep the whole time. So I was like, yeah, there's no way Bilbo is going to write this book, you know. So it's early October. When Frodo sees in the mountain frost, he has an inkling to get back to the Shire finally. Sam thinks the same, and then Sam says, what does he say? Let me take it. Well, Mr. Frodo, we've been far and unseen a deal, and yet I don't think we've found a better place than this. There's something of everything here, if you understand me. The Shire and the Golden Wood and Gondor and the King's houses and inns and meadows and mountains all mixed, and yet somehow I feel we ought to be going soon. I'm worried about my gaffer, to tell the truth.
Yes, something of everything, Sam, except the sea, Frodo had answered, and he repeated it now to himself. Except the sea. That day, Frodo spoke to Elrond, and it was agreed that they should leave the next morning. To their delight, Gandalf said, I think I shall come too, at least as far as Bree. I want to see Butterbur.
Alright, so that kind of gets the end of the plot of this chapter, which is right there. A little swoop. But anyways, they're going to depart, so they got to say bye to Bilbo now. And he gives Frodo 3 books. He says translations from Elvish. So I believe this might be like some sort of his accounts of like the Silmarillion and stuff from then. I don't exactly know what the 3 would correspond to. There's other people. I'm sure Tolkien nerds have gone in for that. but either I can't remember or I didn't actually bite on that one, but whatever. All right. To Sam, Bilbo gives the last bit of the Smaug gold that he still had. And he says it'll be useful if he ever gets married, which makes Sam blush, which is kind of funny. And then to Merry and Pippin, I thought this was actually pretty good. This was like almost like birthday party good, where you had that one, you know, the I like half of you, half as much, you know, that quote. But anyways, he gives them fancy smoking pipes and then Shire advice. And so the Shire advice is, don't let your heads get too big for your hats, but if you don't finish growing up soon, you're going to find hats and clothes expensive. What do you make of that?
Kind of you guys have clearly done some great things and goofball, so don't become egotistical. Yeah. But also, you're physically really large.
So what's the deeper meaning of that?
I think it's that it's kind of, you're adults now because of this journey.
Yeah.
And you're no longer, you can't be as playful as you once were. So if you don't, if you don't kind of reach adulthood soon, you are maybe going to be kind of out of place.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, actually that's a little bit, yeah, that's probably a bit more right than what I said too. Cause I thought it's like, if you can't keep growing forever, then right. Again, maybe you're actually kind of right. Like they could, but then they're just gonna be weird.
Right. Right. But not necessarily, I think it's like that you're saying, it's not really physically, it's that like
maturity.
Right. Yeah. They've matured to a point now where they're kind of adults, but they have to come to terms with it. And they have to behave that way. They have to act right. The part.
Right. And it's definitely time for them to return to normal life and even settle down, you know,
right.
Like
right.
This adventure's over. Right. All right. So Bilbo, he says he wants to, Bilbo actually says he's like, hey, Frodo, can you, still got that ring? Could you show me the ring?
Yeah, yeah. I remember that thing I used to have.
Right. And then he remembers, oh, that was the whole point of the journey to get rid of it, right? But yeah. Mm-hmm. And Frodo's just calmly like, yeah, I had to lose that thing, Bilbo. Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of awkward, but then interesting.
And
he
kind of deliberately tries to not talk about it, right?
Right. Well, I wouldn't either. But yeah, so the chapter, though, it wraps up with the four hobbits and Gandalf getting ready to depart out for the Shire, but Elrond comes to say goodbye to him, and we can kind of just end the chapter with his lines. So it says, as Frodo stood upon the threshold, Elrond wished him a fair journey and blessed him, and he said,
I think, Frodo, that you will not need to come back unless you come very soon. For about this time of the year, when the leaves are gold before the fall, look for Bilbo in the woods of the Shire. I shall be with him.
These words no one else heard, and Frodo kept them to himself.
Okay, thanks, y'all.
Last time, sing this. And we'll all go together to Bolvaire Mountain Time, all around the blue and we'll have one more. Let's see.
Thank you.